Hello, and welcome to Learning English from the Voice of America. I'm Katie Weaver. Today on the show, we talk a lot about food in America. We report about a growing trend in the restaurant industry that serves the interests of both adventurous eaters and cooks. We also explore the history of one of the most popular food sauces in the United States. Few American kitchens are without it. Have you already guessed what it is? You might be surprised to learn the sauce's origin. And later, we visit a California cafe chain. But food and drink might not be its main appeal. At this cafe, you can get good coffee and great business connections. As always, we end our program with an American story. This week, it's The Count and the Wedding Guest by O. Henry. Food halls, where different food sellers gather in one place, are becoming popular in New York City. The real estate company Cushman and Wakefield says the number of food halls in the United States grew more than 37% in the first 9 months of 2016. Property developers have even opened food halls inside large apartment buildings. Todd English, a famous chef, helped the trend begin in New York when he opened Todd English's Food Hall at the Plaza Hotel in 2010. A food hall called Eataly, which sells mostly Italian food, opened soon after. It is operated by the well-known chefs Mario Batali and Lydia Bastianich. In the last 6 months, 4 new food halls have opened in New York. Jonathan Butler is the co-founder of the popular outdoor food market Smorgasburg and the Bergen Food Hall, which opened in 2014.
The food is kind of the new rock and roll. It's the thing that the public is just so excited about.
Butler spoke recently at a conference called Cities for Tomorrow. He discussed the difficulties of operating a food hall. The New York Times newspaper organized the conference. In large cities like New York, it costs a lot to open and operate a restaurant. Food halls give chefs the chance to open a smaller space with less risk. The food sellers at Bergen began their careers at outdoor food stands, food trucks, or as caterers. Food halls are a way for them to test the popularity of their food without opening a restaurant. Danny Garcia is general manager at Landhouse, which sells food at festivals and outdoor markets. But its only permanent place to sell food is the Bergen Food Hall.
This gives us a little bit of flexibility because, you know, it's less maintenance than having an entire restaurant. It's a little bit easier to manage.
Now, Ashley Thompson joins me with a story about a favorite American sauce. At any given time, about 97% of American kitchens have a bottle of ketchup. American ketchup is made from red tomatoes, vinegar, salt, sugar, and other ingredients. It has both a sweet and salty taste. It is, without question, America's condiment. But it was not always that way. In fact, the story of ketchup begins over 500 years ago in Southeast Asia.
Andy F. Smith is a professor of food history in New York City. He has published many books about American food, including Pure Ketchup, A History of America's National Condiment. The word ketchup, Smith says, most likely comes from a Chinese dialect called amoy. Keqiap meant the brine of pickled fish. It probably originated in a Chinese community in northern Vietnam, Smith adds. Yes, America's condiment developed from fish sauce. The sauce and the word reached Indonesia, Smith explains. That is where, in his words, the English ran into it.
They had a colony in Indonesia in the late 17th century, and it is from there that the word now ketchup goes into the English language.
From Indonesia, ketchup made its way into British kitchens and cookbooks.
Everything you could think of, they made a ketchup out of it. And that is one way to preserve those foods for longer periods of time, and then it was used on spicing foods.
Early British ketchup was made from many kinds of foods, such as walnuts, mushrooms, and anchovies, Smith explains, but never, ever tomatoes.
All of the early recipes for ketchup have nothing to do with tomatoes.
Tomatoes are native to the Andes Mountains in South America. Tomato plants were first grown for food around 500 BC in what is now southern Mexico and Central America. Spanish explorers took the plant's seeds northward into the Caribbean and then back to Europe. Tomatoes arrived in the American colonies sometime in the late 17th century, Smith says. For many years, however, some countries did not believe tomatoes were healthy to eat. Medical theories at the time considered the tomato to be a cold food. People living in cold weather countries thought they would get sick if they ate tomatoes. But medical theories about tomatoes changed. By the 1830s, they were thought to be good for health in many ways. Tomato pills even became popular medicine, Smith says. It was around then that tomato production in America took off. They were easy and low cost to grow. But there was one problem.
The problem is that they all mature about the same time, from late July through early October, depending on where you are. And when the tomato comes out, that's massive amounts of tomatoes are produced, and you can only eat so many fresh tomatoes.
By the end of the growing season, American farmers had more tomatoes than they knew what to do with. So people began preserving tomatoes in different ways. Making ketchup from tomatoes was one solution.
Smith says two major things led to tomato ketchup's rise in American cuisine: advertising and low cost. The American food company Heinz led the way.
Heinz advertised it, promoted it. They were in the right position at the right time in the early 20th century when the food health and food safety movements were taking off in the United States, and they claimed that the tomato had no ingredients that were dangerous with the type of ketchup that they were making, and so they promoted it as a health food. So they just dominated the market through advertising and promotion, and they got a good product.
In its early days, tomato ketchup was mostly used in cooking. It was not considered the condiment that it is today. Enter the hot dog and the hamburger, Smith explains. Both became part of American cuisine in the late 1800s and early 1900s.
As soon as those became among the more important American foods, then ketchup became the condiment of choice.
Heinz continues to dominate the ketchup market in the United States and in many countries worldwide. Today, most of the world's ketchup is produced where it all began, Asia. In fact, the Xinjiang Uyghur Autonomous Region of China produces almost 20% of the world's ketchup trade, The Economist magazine reports. The far western region grows some 70% of all of China's tomatoes. And as a whole, China grows 25% of the world's tomatoes.
Smith says he is impressed by the tomatoes' quick rise in China.
Tomatoes were not an important part of Asian cuisine until the 20th century. And what's surprising was how quickly the tomato has become an important product in China.
Some may think of ketchup as all American, but history shows its roots are much older than the United States itself. And its connection to several Asian countries, both in the past and in the present, is strong. Next up, we head to the West Coast to visit a cafe where one can get food and business connections.
Coupa Cafe is a restaurant where over the years, Apple's Steve Jobs, Facebook's Mark Zuckerberg, and Google's Sergey Brin have been seen. The cafe is in Palo Alto, California. Palo Alto is at the heart of Silicon Valley, home to some of the world's largest technology companies and some of the smallest startups. Coupa Cafe is where many people buy coffee and make business plans. The owner of the cafe is Jean-Paul Coupal. He started the cafe with his mother and his sister in 2004.
We really try to create a homey place, a homey environment where everybody feels comfortable.
The Coupa logo was seen on a cup in the 2010 movie The Social Network about Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg. The cafe serves Venezuelan coffee and a few Venezuelan dishes.
Because the cafe is in Silicon Valley, it has tried some of the latest inventions in technology. In 2013, Coupa Cafe started accepting bitcoins, a digital payment system outside of traditional banks. "We want to be part of the technology," Coupal said. The cafe is also a place for people to hold meetings. I remember seeing Mark Zuckerberg sitting here and having meetings, said Eric Sokol, an associate professor of obstetrics and gynecology at Stanford University. Sokol said he had many professional opportunities come about at Coupa Cafe.
Just from sitting here and having coffee and having a kind of a work business meeting at Coupa, I ended up becoming an advisor to two startup companies. That's the kind of crazy nest of connections that can occur here at Coupa.
Currently, he is an advisor to a healthcare-related startup and a new investment fund. Both opportunities came when he was at the cafe.
Because the cafe lets customers stay all day, many people do work there. A lot of the startups in the area come, and they like to work at Coupa, coding all day, Kupal said. We've seen a lot of products that got developed at Coupa. The cafe also attracts students from colleges nearby, like Stanford University. Katie Kennedy is a student from a local community college. She said she knew that opportunities could come from chance encounters at the cafe.
I'm currently teaching myself JavaScript here at Coupa right now. If someone happened to look over my shoulder and saw like what I was doing, I would definitely not say no to like any help.
Currently, there are 8 Coupa cafes. All were hand-painted by Kupal's mother and sister. The food's good, the coffee's good, Sokol said. It just has the right atmosphere, the right mix of people. I'm Mario Ritter.
And I'm Olivia Leal.
Now it's time for an American story. Here is The Count and the Wedding Guest by O. Henry.
Andy Donovan had his dinner each evening in the house on 2nd Avenue, where he lived in a furnished room. One evening at dinner, he met a new guest, a young lady, Miss Conway. Miss Conway was small and quiet. She was wearing a plain brown dress. She seemed interested in very little, except her dinner. And her dinner did not interest her very much. She looked up at Mr. Donovan and spoke his name, and then began to eat again. Mr. Donovan had a smile that everyone liked. He smiled at her and then thought no more about her. 2 weeks later, Andy was sitting outside the house, enjoying the cool evening. He heard a movement behind him. He turned his head and could not turn it back again. Coming out of the door was Miss Conway. She was wearing a night black dress of soft, thin cloth. Her hat was black. She was putting black gloves on her hand. There was no white and no color anywhere about her. All black. Someone in her family had died. Mr. Donovan was certain about that. Her rich golden hair lay soft and thick at the back of her neck. Her face was not really pretty, but her large gray eyes made it almost beautiful. She looked up into the sky with an expression of sadness. All black, readers. Think of her. All black. And that golden hair, and looking sadly far away. Mr. Donovan suddenly decided to think about Miss Conway. He stood up. "It's a fine, clear evening, Miss Conway," he said.
"It is to them with a heart to enjoy it, Mr. Donovan," said Miss Conway.
She took a deep, slow breath.
"I hope no one of your family has died." "Death has taken," said Miss Conway, "not one of my family, but one who... I must not speak of my troubles to you, Mr. Donovan."
"Why not, Miss Conway? Perhaps I could understand." Miss Conway smiled a little, and oh, her face was sadder than when she was not smiling.
"Laugh, and the world laughs with you," she said. "But the world is not interested in sadness. I've learned that, Mr. Donovan. I have no friends in this city, but you have been kind to me. Thank you for it."
He had done nothing except offer her the salt at dinner. "It's not easy to be alone in New York," said Mr. Donovan. "But when New York is friendly, it's very friendly. Shall we take a little walk in the park? It might be good for you."
"Thanks, Mr. Donovan. I would enjoy it. But I don't want my sadness to make you sad."
They went through the open gates of the park and found a quiet seat.
"We were going to be married soon," said Miss Conway. "He was a real count. He had land and a big house in Italy. Count Fernando Mazzini was his name. My father didn't want me to marry him. Once we ran away to get married, and my father followed and took me home. I was afraid they were going to fight. But then my father agreed. Fernando went to Italy to make everything ready for me. My father's very proud. Fernando wanted to give me several $1,000s for new clothes, and my father said no. When Fernando went away, I came to the city. I work in a shop. 3 days ago, I had a letter from Italy. It said that Fernando had been killed. That's why I'm wearing black. My heart has died, Mr. Donovan, with Fernando. I cannot take interest in anyone. I should not keep you from your friends who can smile and enjoy things with you. Shall we walk back to the house?"
Now, readers, if a girl tells a man her heart has died, he wants to make it live again. "I'm very sorry," said Mr. Donovan. "No, we won't walk back to the house yet. And don't say you have no friends in this city, Miss Conway. I'm your friend, and I want you to believe that."
"I have his picture here," said Miss Conway. "I wear it on a chain around my neck. I never showed it to anyone, but I will show it to you, Mr. Donovan. I believe you to be a true friend."
Mr. Donovan looked for a long time with much interest at the picture. The face of Count Mazzini commanded interest. It was wise, bright, the face of a strong, happy man who could be a leader of other men.
"I have a larger picture in my room," said Miss Conway. "When we return, I will show you that. I have nothing more to help me remember Fernando, but he will always live in my heart. I'm sure of that."
Mr. Donovan decided that he wanted to take the Count's place in Miss Conway's heart. He did not seem to think he could fail. He would be friendly. He would keep smiling. When they returned to the house, she ran to her room and brought down the picture of the Count. Mr. Donovan looked at it. No one could have guessed what he was thinking.
"He gave me this on the night he left for Italy," said Miss Conway. "A fine-looking man," said Mr. Donovan warmly. "Miss Conway, will you go to Coney Island with me next Sunday afternoon?"
A month later, they told the other guests in the house on Second Avenue that they were going to be married. Miss Conway continued to wear black. A week later, the two sat on the same seat in the park. Donovan had had a sad face all day. He was so quiet tonight that Miss Conway had to ask him why.
What's wrong tonight, Andy?
Nothing, Maggie.
You never were like this before. What is it?
It's nothing much, Maggie.
Yes, it is. And I want to know. Is it some other girl? Why don't you go to her if you want her? Take your arm away.
I will tell you then, said Andy wisely. But you will not understand. Have you heard about Mike Sullivan? Everyone calls him Big Mike Sullivan.
I've never heard about him, said Maggie. Who is he?
He is the most important man in New York. He is a mile high and as broad as the East River. If you say anything bad about Big Mike, a million men will be ready to fight you. Big Mike is a friend of mine. I am only a little man, but Mike is as good a friend to a little man as he is to a big man. I met him today by chance, and what do you think he did? He came up to me to shake my hand. I told him I was going to be married in 2 weeks. Andy, says he, I will come to the wedding. That is what he said to me, and he always does what he says. You don't understand it, Maggie, but I want to have Big Mike Sullivan at our wedding. It would make me very proud.
Then why don't you ask him to come?
Said Maggie. There's a reason why I can't, said Andy sadly. Don't ask me the reason, for I can't tell you.
But can't you smile at me?
Said Maggie. Maggie, said Andy after a few minutes, do you love me as much as you loved Count Mazzini? He waited a long time, but Maggie did not reply. And then suddenly she put her head against his shoulder and began to cry. She held his arm and her tears wet the black dress. Maggie, Maggie, said Andy, forgetting his own trouble. Tell me about it.
Andy, said Maggie, what I told you was not true. And there never was any count. There never was a man in love with me. All the other girls had men in love with them. And, Andy, I look good in black. You know I do. So I went to a shop where I could buy that picture. And that story about the count, none of it was true. I said he had died because I wanted to wear black. And no one can love me because I didn't tell the truth. I never liked anyone but you, and that's all.
But Andy did not move away. Instead, his arm pulled her nearer to him. She looked up and saw that he was smiling.
Do you still love me, Andy?
Sure, said Andy. You have made everything fine, Maggie. I hoped you would do it before the wedding day. Good girl.
Andy, said Maggie after a little time, did you believe all that story about the count?
No, not very much, said Andy. Because that is Big Mike Sullivan's picture that you're wearing on the chain around your neck.
That's all the time we have for today's show. But tune in tomorrow for another Learning English program on The Voice of America. I'm Katie Weaver. Thanks for joining us.